Hey everybody, I am back, and I am back again with the one and only Doug Collins UX, a one-man show and a UX army of one from Denver, Colorado, and he works in a fintech firm. Most of you who are listening already know him. So he's a great regular to have on the podcast. Doug, welcome to the podcast.
Hello again. Thanks for having me back. And hey, everybody, good to be talking again.
Oh, sounds pretty cheerful. Nice.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's it snowed a few times here in Denver in the last week, and it's not snowing now. It did snow this morning. So I guess this time of year, whenever it's not snowing, it makes everything a little more cheery.
Well, we are at 0 degrees Fahrenheit in Minnesota, and by the time I wake up tomorrow morning, it'll be like -7 or something like that.
Way more cheery here.
Right. So I'm just trying to stay positive.
Yeah.
So so Doug and I will try to crank out two episodes today, one about UX and the other one about Colorado, because Doug lives in Denver and he's lived in Colorado all his life, and I personally want to learn a little more about the state because I've been there, and I absolutely love the area. So hopefully that episode will also be interesting to some of you guys. But let's start with UX, and Doug and I, we discussed the topic for this episode, and Doug wants to talk about UX failures.
That's
pretty cheerful for a failure. So I'll let Doug drive, and should be interesting. I'm excited, and I'm going to be asking questions and basically, you know, jumping in and out developing some topics deeper. Doug, go ahead.
Yeah. So getting on the topic of failure, this came up in a conversation I had with one of my fellow Denver UXers recently about how there's a lot of self-doubt and there's a lot of imposter syndrome that seems to be rife in the world of UX. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that we only ever hear about the good side of UX, you know, the things that worked.
You're going to talk about the dark side?
Things that went wrong. The dark side, maybe not dark patterns. We could do a whole other show on that.
That's what I meant.
Yeah. Yeah, no, we're going to talk about failures. We're going to talk about things that went wrong. Because in everybody's UX world, there's a project, at least one, and I'm certain usually a lot more than that, of things that just didn't go the way that you wanted it to. You know, either the results weren't great, a project was unfinished, you know, something went wrong. And I kind of want to talk about that because, you know, when you have all the success that's being talked about all around you, it gets to kind of feel like, the default is success, right? That, you should always be successful no matter what. And if for some reason you're not keeping up with the Joneses, right?
Well, so, to quickly comment on that piece, I recently tweeted that, you know, if you when you listen, when you hear about successes, whether it's, whether you're hiring a financial advisor or a trader or somebody else and somebody just shows just awesome statistics, like, for one successful person, there's thousands and thousands who failed, because that's how the world works. I mean, you literally hear only about successes. I mean, obviously, you also hear about failures, but those are like one-offs, right? Like, you know, if somebody fails really bad, like, you know, this trader lost $20 million on shorts because he bet against Netflix and Netflix went up, right? So they would cover that person because, you know, he's a one-off that people know about. But there's probably hundreds and thousands more traders who lost $20 million or more shorting Netflix They just never got covered or never got exposed to the media. So yeah, I mean, statistics wise, and for the UX, it's the same for every successful, UX implementation, there's like thousands and thousands of apps that just suck big time.
Right. Yeah. And that is a great example of what's called survivorship bias, which is, it's kind of a logical error in our way of thinking, where we concentrate on the people or things that make it past or through some process, and overlook those things that didn't, because the things that don't, they aren't around. They aren't there to get that visibility. So when we look at the things that have succeeded and look at the things that have gone well, we draw false conclusions in saying that, well, if this has gone well for this person, it will go well for every other person that's in that same scenario. So survivorship bias is a real cognitive bias, and one that we have to fight against. And it's not one that's really talked about as much in the world of UX, because we don't...
We are not survivors.
Right. Well, I guess that depends on who you talk to. But we don't like to talk about our failures. You know, we're kind of trained. We're in a competitive market. You know, even though we are a very open group, we kind of compete with each other and for jobs and positions and attention. So talking about our failures is one of those things that just doesn't happen very often. So I want people out there to understand that failures happen all the time, right? And kind of to your point, there are those guys that shorted Netflix and lost millions of dollars. And I'm sure somebody out there sold their Amazon stock back at $100 $100 a share before it went up to, I don't even know what it's at now, but well over 1,000, I'm sure. Yeah, so
slightly above 2,000.
Oh my God. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wish I had bought Amazon stock a while ago. Then I wouldn't be on this podcast though. So,
right. or Bitcoin for like 60 cents and then sold 20,000, right?
Right. Yeah, I talked my brother out of buying Bitcoin at $3 a coin, and I haven't been forgiven for that one. It looks like Amazon's at $1,654.93 right now. I had a good day. It was up $15. So, if you got that Amazon stock, I'd say hold on for the ride, at least for now.
Stock market today is a different conversation. I mean, we can talk about that as well, but I believe we are in the middle of a huge correction and recession, especially with everything that is going on at the government level.
Well, to make myself very clear, I don't speak as a representative of my company when I say any of this, which is important to get through. This is just all my own personal opinions, and I have no insider knowledge or anything like that. Despite where I work and the position that I'm in, I still mostly just draw things.
there you go.
But the stock market correction and that sort of thing. That's another thing too. You know, with the stock market, we hear about the Warren Buffetts, right? You know, everybody knows Warren Buffett's name and all the big investors out there. But we don't hear about the guys that place those gambling bets. So
yeah, there's one Warren Buffett, and there's a lot of Warren Schmuffets.
Definitely. So talking about some of our failures, I want to talk about personal failures to start off with. I think I'll lead with one of mine that I feel like I learned a good lesson from. And this was a project that I did when I was back at Nordstrom Bank, working as a corporate trainer at the time. We were trying to make a training system we would use kind of in lieu of training our employees on the call center software. So there is software whenever you call into a call center that the employee on the phone uses to see everything about your credit account in this case. Mm-hmm. They'll use it to make notes about you. They'll go back through and look kind of at other conversations, the history of your account, blah, 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 blah. And the problem that we had is that we didn't really have a QA environment for that. Everything was live. So we couldn't teach on that software unless we were actually taking live phone calls, which was sort of a big project, right? You don't want to put brand new representatives on the phones taking live phone calls on their second day, but you did want to be able to expose them to the software in some meaningful way, right?
But you could use, testing people to call in, right?
No, we couldn't because we didn't have even any QA accounts. Everything that was in our system was all live accounts, so we'd actually be accessing real customer data.
I would assume you could register yourself as a customer and call as a customer, right? And then test the system.
If you had an open credit account, you could have done that. I didn't have a Nordstrom credit account at the time, and I still don't have a Nordstrom credit account. So
okay.
But
so nobody even suggested or volunteered.
Right. And you know, to be perfectly frank, you could see a lot in those systems. We could see your most recent credit score. We could see your mortgage history. We could see all sorts of information about
scary.
You. Yeah, well, you know, when you have a credit card company, you kind of assume that they can see those things. I mean, your credit card company knows your financial history. That's shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone. But we could see, you know, the type of things that a credit report would contain, which was, you know, your credit score, any recent delinquent accounts, that sort of thing. So we wouldn't ask anyone to volunteer to do that with their own credit account, because we'd be kind of exploring areas of their life that, especially in front of a, you know, our classes were 20 to 30 people. So, you know, it was a large group that you were going in front of, and a lot of people you didn't really know that well either. So what I had to do is I had to build a system for us to train on. And I had some experience working in Adobe Flash, which is what we were using way back in 2011, I think, is when I was working on this project.
Literally flashback, right?
Yeah. Oh, Adobe Flash, how I don't really miss you at all. But working on this project, and I thought, you know, I'd take this kind of in chunks and work on it. And the more I worked on it, the more that I realized the system had much more complexity than what I was prepared to actually create within Flash. And it got to the point where this project was just really mired down, and it sort of worked and it sort of didn't, and didn't really give that great of an experience. And in the end, we used it until I moved on into a different role, then I'm not sure that it ever got used again after that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, kind of what that taught me was that, you know, I wasn't testing this as I went along to figure out whether or not it was useful for our classes. My chances to test were, okay, well, we're putting it in front of a class and hopefully this works the way that I want it to. and it wasn't really working that well. So I wasn't testing as I went along. I wasn't doing any sort of iterative testing or going back and trying to make any changes on the fly. I wasn't bringing in anybody to give me feedback until I was actually putting it in front of people. And I wasn't prepared to do something that was complex enough to actually meet any of the needs. What we ended up coming out with that system was a very, very small slice of the overall system, the overall credit management system. So I'm not sure that it was really useful, and it was, I still look back at that time and I absolutely shudder to think about the work that I did on that. You know, even though I tried hard and did my best, it still didn't work out that well. So I learned the value at that point in time of doing the iterative testing, trying to get feedback and making sure that I'm putting my product in front of my users in order to figure out kind of what their pain points and what was going wrong and why things weren't working the way that they expected it to. But it wasn't really a fun journey, to say the least. And you know, I think most designers, I don't know about most, but there are a lot of designers out there that look back and just look back at anything that they do and go, I don't want to look back at that. And oh God, I can't believe I made that choice or that choice. But this was different. This was, it didn't work, and it was entirely my fault. So you also got to take a little bit of personal responsibility there too.
Sure. So the constraints of not having the ability to test, what was the main issue here, right?
Yeah, I think so. Although I'm not very good at being assertive sometimes. You know, that's
or like, are you trying to take the responsibility for that, for something that you couldn't control, or you failed to do something that you could control?
Well, so it was an artificial constraint, really, of not being able to put it in front of users. I was told that I couldn't do that, but I didn't push back at all on it. And in reality, that's what I should have done, is to say, look, you know, I understand that our call center reps' time is valuable and we don't want to take anybody off the floor for too long, but if I can get 5 or 10 minutes with these people just to get a sanity check to see that what I'm doing is actually working and is working the way that it's supposed to and is, you know, comfortable for people to use, that would be tremendously helpful and would aid me a lot. I didn't do that. And that's one of those lessons that I learned from that too, is that that sometimes you have to step up and stand up for what you need. You know, in the end, you're the one that really knows what you need. And if you don't ask for it, you're not going to get it. Especially at organizations where you're kind of the riding solo or in a small group, and, you know, maybe two or three designers, it's very hard to stand up and have that voice, especially when it's sort of a sea of dissent that you're going into. And that was a lesson that I learned, that you have to do that sometimes.
Do you remember why you made this decision not to push?
Because I was timid, and I still am. But I've gotten better about it. I'm not a people pleaser, unless you want me to be. In that case, I'm totally a people pleaser. But that's just kind of the person that I am. And sometimes you almost have to act a part until you actually are that part, right? I don't feel very confident. I don't feel very outgoing. And I don't generally, this is the weird part about doing UX research, is I don't generally like talking to a whole bunch of other people, that especially people that I don't know well.
But I do it all the time. Let me do my work.
Yeah, exactly. But I do it all the time. That's part of the job. And I've kind of convinced myself, okay, act like I'm outgoing, act like I know you know, everything that's going on, even when I don't, and act like whatever I'm doing. And sooner or later, that act becomes reality. And it's a difficult thing to do, but you got to do it.
Do you have any examples from your recent experience where you ran into a similar situation where you kind of needed to push a little more? And first you kind of thought, maybe I should not push, but then you kind of went back and remembered about that experience that kind of made you learn, and then you kind of went back and said, no, you know, I still want to do that, and then you got it. Do you have an example like that?
Yeah, so we have, in my current company, the way that things are, I don't know how much I can get into without getting myself in trouble, and I don't want to get myself in trouble. But essentially, in order to start a user testing program, I had to get the permission of a particular person who is going to remain nameless at this point.
Sure. But person is good enough.
Right. And kind of this person's role was to sort of manage the people that talked directly to our clients. So we have a group of people that talk directly to the financial advisors that call in to us. I was trying to actually get through to our financial advisors. And you know, this person is very sensitive about any sort of communications we have with the financial advisors, because it directly affects their attitude towards her team. And so that makes a lot of sense.
I can relate to that. I've been in a similar situation. I think we even contacted a couple of financial advisors when we did a project at Ameriprise. Yeah, I can relate.
Right. And I'll say this, financial advisors, everyone that I've talked to have been universally awesome. There's, you know,
well, they have to be good people by definition.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they're people, right?
Right.
And especially when you're asking someone for help and you're asking them to help you make the product that they use every day better, people are generally tremendously receptive to that. But there is this attitude that sometimes crops up within a business that we can't ask for help because that might be seen as an inconvenience, right? So
yeah, like the time is valuable. They have more important things to worry about and stuff like that. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Common story.
Right. Absolutely. You hear that all the time. But the truth is that people want to help. And especially when the value in it for them is that they're going to come up with a better product that they get to use every single day, they are usually in. And if they're not, you bait the hook a little bit and, you know, say give a gift card out or, you know, some small reward. That's usually way more than enough to push them over the edge to say, yeah, I'll help out for half an hour and run through this test with you. Mm-hmm. So But this particular person was pushing back pretty hard because she was concerned that that wouldn't be the case, that this would be seen as an inconvenience. And so this person has a very strong personality, and there's nothing wrong with that, I should say. In her role, you kind of need to have one. But she was very adamant that we not go forward with this, or that we go forward with this under her terms. And it was not just me, but with the help of a few other people, we sort of stood pat and said, no, we need to do this. We need to do this under our own terms. You know, we'll make sure that we treat everybody fairly, but we need to make sure that this user testing is a priority within the organization. And that exactly brought me back to that time when I was back at Nordstrom saying, well, you know, maybe we shouldn't, you know, bother people. I'm not sure if we should do this. Because I'd already learned that lesson to know how valuable that was to even have that small amount of time with users to get their feedback. So being able to sort of reach back into my past and having learned that lesson was hugely important for me. And one of those pieces that I'm glad that I had under my belt, even if it was extremely uncomfortable at the time.
Well, I mean, this is a good example, and I think I have two comments here. One, it's pretty common to, and frustrating at the same time, to see how certain people would make a decision for somebody without asking them. So you don't know if the advisor, you know, really doesn't want to spend or, you know, according to their vocabulary, waste their time talking to UX people because they have, you know, multi-million dollar clients to manage and build financial plans. But at the same time, they don't know. They basically steal that right from the advisor to make the decision themselves. You know, maybe I am so miserable with the software that I would be happy to talk to somebody who can actually help me figure that out, right?
Right.
But then some manager in the corporate just made a decision to completely bypass the financial advisor and leave that person out of the process. So that's one comment. And the second piece is, I think, you know, for those of you guys who are listening in, are running into situations like that, potentially, I think a really good way to negotiate your way is to say, you know, look, I was hired as a UX designer, and, you know, hopefully you have some time and a good track record to be on good terms with the company. And you can say, testing and talking to the end user is a critical part of my job. And you can even show that person like job description, right? Like testing and stuff like that.
Right.
I mean, I don't know how formal you want to get, like, you know, I'm going to go and complain to the CEO and show that, you know, the ability to talk to end users is in my, you know, employment contract, right? Or something like that.
Right.
But basically it is the part of your job. And, maybe you can even use that person's job to kind of help him or her relate to your issue. You know, for example, your job is to do X, Y, Z, and you get to do all three X, Y, and Z, and I am not able to do my Z because you are preventing me from it. So just kind of like, you know, be professional and respectful, but kind of like negotiation is a really, really awesome skill to have. And I wish I took some, you know, negotiation classes when I was getting my MBA. I don't know why I did not, but trying to kind of learn here and there as I listen to people and, you know, now real time thinking myself, right?
Right.
I mean, this is a real time thought. I've never thought about this before, but you kind of gave me this example and the thoughts are just coming out. So this is a learning for me. That's why, you know, I'm doing podcasts not to, you know, become famous and get rich, although that would be nice too. But it's just so awesome to kind of articulate certain thoughts because you may never think about certain things unless you, you know, talk that through with somebody and actually articulate it, and then all of a sudden it becomes a learning.
Right.
So that's the second comment that I think could be very useful. to use as a negotiation tactic in situations like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I kind of on the point of whether or not people will think, you know, this is a waste of time or they're not going to be willing to do this. You know, one thing that I wish I could give to anybody that says that is I wish I could give them my son and have him take him to the grocery store and just take him shopping. My son is 20 months old. He's just now 20 months old as of a couple of days ago. And he loves talking to everybody at the grocery store, even though his words are mostly sign language and hi and that sort of thing. He will say hello to anyone. And when I'm there by myself, you know, I'm there on a mission. I got to get the jalapenos, I got to get the beans, I got to get the rice, and I got to get to the checkout stand. So, you know, if I make eye contact with anybody else, it's usually by accident. But with him, it's, you know, it's waves, it's hi, it's you know, pointing at things and going ooh, you know, all the cute things that that a 20-month-old does. And you forget how friendly people are, because you know it's hard to frown at a baby, and most people won't do that. Mm-hmm. But you would expect some people would, you know, not acknowledge them or just kind of move on. But almost 100% of people, you know, will smile, wave back, say hello. And he's got a penchant for the older ladies. He likes the grandmas, and he will say hello to every one of them, and they'll always smile back and you know, respond positively. And for me, that's just the reminder that people are outgoing, people are nice. If you're nice to them, so it is part of the approach, right? You know, you want to make sure that you're coming in respectfully and pleasantly, and you know, stating your value proposition to them is something that will be important and useful to them. But it's rare if you do that to get a negative response, and especially a strongly negative response. And you know, that's why I love not the only reason, but that's one of the reasons why I love taking my son to the grocery store on the weekend is. I get that weekly reminder that it's going to be okay for me to reach out and talk to these people, because the world isn't really such a bad place.
Well, I mean, babies and kids, they're, you know, awesome icebreakers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A stranger can, you know, say, oh, you know, your kid is so cute. And all of a sudden, this is an open invitation to, you know, say something to that stranger and, you know, strike a conversation like you are neighbors, right?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, kind of going back to negotiating, yeah, it's kind of it's really a combination of, you know, being respectful and being able to talk professionally, but at the same time, you may not always get your way just because, you know, people can only be triggered by certain things and, you know, like in this example, if you say, you know, you do get to do your XYZ, but I'm doing XY but not Z. So, and this can really get stuck in the manager's head. And, you know, even if she tells you no now, she may still kind of go back to her desk and kind of think about it and then feel bad that, you know, although I kind of care about not bothering my advisors, you know, he kind of has a point that I'm not letting him do my his job. And right. Then she can come back to you later and say, you know, I kind of give it another thought. And maybe you start with this guy and talk to him for 10 minutes and then see how it goes. So, yeah, negotiation, and especially in UX, when you have just, you know, more powerful people controlling certain things that you can or cannot do, that's I can't remember on Twitter a few months ago whether it was you or somebody else, maybe it was you, you said, you know, what kind of skills should UX designer have, and I think I said negotiation,
right?
I still strongly believe that, and those are two skills which is, you know, pretty hard to combine in one person, but it's doable if you have a goal of having those two skills. It's truly doable, but it requires some work. So
right, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. The negotiation piece is a big one to have, and I think, you know, political skills in general are a big one to have. You know, one of the things that I look at is as important to a UXer's skill set is the ability to facilitate communication between different groups. And part of that is understanding what's important to each group, what their goals are, and what the constraints that they're working in as well. But in order to be able to effectively do that, you need to be able to state things tactfully and to put pieces in ways that are important to your audience, right? You need to be able to speak their language. And I think too often, either that's not done or it's done carelessly, and that can lead to problems when that happens. And for a lot of people that don't take those negotiating skills or don't just have them innately, it takes a lot of trial and error to figure out sort of the political side of the job. And it kind of stinks to say that office politics is something that you have to be skilled at in order to be good at it, but it's true. I mean, you really do have to get used to that. And that's one of those things that you can't really learn in a boot camp or a college course, or even sometimes in internships. You're just not exposed to things too well. You really have to cut your teeth on the job. And for those that are kind of starting out on UX jobs and UX careers, I would say expect to learn and do your best and probably have some failures there, but keep them in your back pocket so that you keep those lessons around and have them to grow with in the future.
Absolutely. And I think just to add a little bit more to that, I think emotional intelligence is the new currency in the business world today. That's why it's a little bit of a stretch, but I think it's still true when people say, don't hire the skills, hire the culture. You can always train the skills,
right?
But you cannot train the culture. And this, for the most part, is true, although a lot of people are still, hardwired to the old way of thinking, just because, what am I going to hire a person who doesn't know how to do anything and just train him from scratch? So obviously there's a balance, but being emotionally intelligent, it's EQ is just a lot more valuable today than IQ. And I think, I don't know if it can be taught in universities or maybe parents or professional connections or meetup people, but somebody needs to, all those people who come out of colleges or, start working in UX or in any other area for that matter, even without colleges, somebody needs to run them through real life scenarios and say, you design something beautiful and you super excited and you go to your manager and, you show it to him or her. And the manager says, it's like literally a piece of crap. It's the worst design I've ever seen. and you have to be ready to hear that. And you should just, say, okay, let me know what I did wrong. Because, you kind of train those extremes. Hopefully the person never experiences that, right?
Right.
But, whether you go to a sports game and some jerk just yells at you for no reason, right? So mm-hmm. Cases like that, I'm kind of like, my son is too young for that. He is 3. But at some point I might just, say, the world, although the world is a beautiful place, it's also not so beautiful place in many aspects. And here's what you should expect, although, hopefully you'll never run into those situations, but it's absolutely possible to have that. So if you're a UX, upcoming UX designer, information architect, whoever you are, just think of all the scenarios where you can just be, thrown off and shut down and, in situations like, this is the worst design I've ever seen. This is the worst idea. This is the stupidest idea I've ever heard, because, managers can be jerks like that.
Right.
And I've heard stories. I don't think anything that extreme happened to me, but, just be prepared and train yourself in terms of responses. You know, it doesn't have to be that somebody tells you this is the worst design I've ever seen. I mean, hopefully most people are more, you know, polite than that. But even if you get like, we're not going to do that. Or, you know, I don't have time. We're just going to go with the old design or something like that. Just be prepared for those kind of outcomes and to avoid situations like, you know, where you blow up and say, you freaking jerk, I'm resigning right now, or I'm going to go to your boss, to the VP and complain about you, or, you know, just, you know, leave the room and slam the door or something like that. There's a lot of options, you know, to react to things like that. So, and I'm personally training myself on some scenarios that I can foresee, you know, what if I have something to tell somebody, what are the options that I can, you know, hear back, and how would I react to some of those things? So I think, I know I've kind of said a lot of things, but hopefully I kind of convey the point that the world is just such a place that you can get any kind of response, and it's human nature. Somebody will push your button. We have a lot of buttons, and there's a lot of stuff in this world that can push those buttons. So the more we can kind of predict and train ourselves for those type of outcomes, particularly, you know, if you're a UX designer trying to do something that is part of your job, but people above don't understand, just, you know, be prepared for all kinds of answers, and, you know, prepare counter answers while being emotionally calm and professional.
Right. Yeah. Well, and speaking of some of the worst designs ever, as you said, can we talk about some of the worst designs ever? Some of the historic failures.
Oh, I would love to. Yeah.
Yeah.
You did some homework, I hear.
Oh, yes. So one of these is an article, or comes from an article that I wrote for UXmas a couple of years ago. Do you know about UXmas? Is that something that you've heard about?
I last Christmas, you know, a month ago, I think I saw that in your tweet.
Right. Yeah.
And that was the only time I saw the word.
So the UXmas group is a part of the UX mastery team, UXmastery.com. Every year, they put out an advent calendar of UX articles. So in the 25 days leading up to Christmas, they give out 25 different UX articles that are sort of fun or vaguely holiday related. And this year, I did something that was like an email chain from Santa's Workshop's UX department. But a couple of years ago.
That's too funny.
A couple of years ago, I wrote about what's called the Hotel of Doom, which is the Ryugyong Hotel. And that, if that sounds odd, it's Korean. It's actually in Pyongyang, North Korea. It's a 105-story building that's built in the heart of the capital of North Korea. It's the tallest unfinished building. And one of the reasons why I like to talk about it is because it's just so interesting. It's been standing for over 30 years. It's not finished. And it kind of looks like a big, one of the reasons why I chose it for the UXmas thing is it looks like a big, ugly Christmas tree sort of hanging over the city. That it's sort of triangular shaped and has some notches in it. It has kind of a topper to it. So it kind of looks vaguely Christmas-esque. But though we're a little bit past that time of year, it's a fun thing to talk about. So it was built or started construction for the World Festival of Youth and Students, which was a society that was oriented towards spreading communist propaganda to young people. And that society had selected Pyongyang as the site for its 13th conference in 1989. So they wanted to have this big hotel to welcome the 20,000 or so participants that they expected, right? So they took a few logical steps. They built the world's largest stadium for this as kind of the part of the lead up to it. They shipped out all the short people from Pyongyang leading up to this, which was also kind of a weird step. But they didn't want anyone to think that North Koreans were short, malnourished. So if you were short, and lived in Pyongyang, you got a trip to the countryside for this time while they were having the festival.
Hopefully expenses paid.
Knowing North Korea.
Yeah, probably not.
Yeah, probably not. And then they started work on the hotel. It was supposed to be the tallest hotel in the world in like the crown jewel of the capital city. So they started working on this in 87, 2 years before the festival was supposed to happen there. Mm-hmm. And they missed their scheduled opening, didn't even come close to it. They didn't have the outside done. There wasn't any sort of construction that was really finished. So rather than admit failure and, scrap the project, they kept working on it and kept working on it, tinkering on it until 1992. And by 1992, they had spent about $750 million on this hotel, and it still wasn't finished. And for North Korea, even, for American standards, that's a lot for a hotel. But for North Korea, that was 2% of their GDP, which is just an absolutely massive figure to spend on any single building. And 1992, this was after the fall of the Soviet Union. Their economy collapsed, and the hotel just sat there until 2008. They started working on it again, and it missed openings in 2012 and 2013. And even today, it sits unfurnished, unoccupied. It's not even lit in the middle of the city. Despite being meant for tourists and being a hotel, it hasn't served a single one in the 30 years plus since its groundbreaking. So obviously kind of a really interesting historical piece. And if you want to read more about the article, you can search the Hotel of Doom in Google. My article is one of the first ones that comes up. You'll see it there. But there's a lot of great information about it. But I think it gives us some really good lessons, right? So one of the lessons I like to take from this is don't lose focus on your user base, right? North Korea is a small country that has almost no tourist presence to it, right? Outside of this one particular festival that got, 20,000 people coming to it, Pyongyang is not really high on the list of places to visit for most of the world. And that's $750 million they spent.
But it's probably on everybody's list of places not to visit.
Right. Yeah. Right. And one of the fun things is to go on YouTube and search for documentaries about or even just YouTube videos about traveling in North Korea. And you'll see all sorts of things like, they'll put you up in the one floor of the hotel that's finished, and all the other floors, all the lights are turned off. There's, no beds in the bedrooms and that sort of thing. So it's kind of an interesting thing to take a look at. So definitely worth a look there. But even now, years later, they're not a tourist destination. And that $750 million they spent would have gone a long way towards helping feed their people, bolster their economy, instead of, being spent on a worthless building that hasn't served its purpose in 30 years. I also like to say, don't design by management, right? North Korea's leaders' insistence on building a 105-story hotel in the middle of the world's least welcoming country was a pretty short-sighted mistake, pun intended, that really prioritized, sort of the flash and the impact of it over functionality. It was never going to be what they wanted it to be, even, possibly even during the festival. So doing something just because your managers think it's a good idea isn't a great way to do it. You need to make sure that you're serving your users, you're understanding their needs, understanding their goals, understanding their pain points, and building towards that, not just doing something because of the hippo, the highest paid person in the office, right?
And that's where the negotiation skills can come in handy.
Absolutely, yeah, kind of tying that all back in. You need to be able to stand up and say, why are we doing this, right? And obviously, maybe North Korea is not the best place to do that. Not great for your life expectancy, apparently, if you try and do that in North Korea. But, in kind of your regular everyday office environment, being able to stand up and say, this doesn't fit with our priorities and what we know about our users is a big piece. And then, kind of also this goes to researching a problem before you solve it, right? They never needed a 105-story hotel in North Korea. They didn't bother to research to see if there was any shortage of accommodation. They never bothered to see whether or not, you know, this would actually do anything to help out with the festival. And in the end, everybody ended up staying in other smaller hotels, and it was fine. You know, looking into
Because, they didn't have a choice, because the hotel was not built.
I guess that's one way of looking at it. You want to stay here? No? All right. Well, I guess you're staying somewhere else. But there wasn't a shortage of housing. There were other, you know, hotels that were less flashy that were available. And this wasn't really necessary. So they didn't bother to research whether or not this was an issue. They just kind of went about doing it because it sounded like a good idea at the time. So it was a very permanent solution to a very short-term problem. So even today, there's still a glut of too much hotel space in Pyongyang. There's still way too many available hotel rooms. It's kind of what I mentioned about those YouTube videos. You can go and look, and the hotels are never anywhere near full. So still not a problem that needs to be solved, but apparently they're still working on it. The rumors are that construction has restarted, and that they've finished the exterior and are now working on some of the interior, trying to get it back up and running and at least get some of the hotel open up. So, you know, if you're a fan of the Hotel of Doom, you don't lose hope quite yet, but that's certainly something that could still happen. So we'll see. One of the interesting things about that is that the hotel was condemned by international inspectors in the late 90s as not safe for human habitation, but that doesn't seem to have stopped anything. So.
there's absolutely no way probably that a structure like that would pass international standards.
It's got all sorts of problems to it. So that's the Hotel of Doom, but certainly an interesting read if you want to. Dan Cummins, do you know Dan Cummins by any chance? Another, not UX podcaster, but just podcaster in general.
Kind of rings a bell.
He does a podcast called The Time Suck, which is essentially he gets stuck researching things online, and he decided that rather than, just keep all of his thoughts to himself, he was going to turn it into a podcast. He's a comedian by trade, a very funny guy, but his podcast is tremendously informative, and I have to recommend. I don't know if he's done one on the Ryugyong Hotel, but if he hasn't, that would be an excellent episode for Time Suck, so I'll have to recommend that. But yeah, he's got awesome. Literally hundreds of episodes, so well worth a listen.
That was great. We kind of crossed the 15-minute mark. I'm thinking, if you don't mind, maybe we, I think it was great conversation, especially the main part of, the real world failures and negotiation, things. So if you don't mind, maybe we wrap this one up and, start a Colorado, discussion.
Yeah,
That's okay with you.
Yeah, definitely. I'll have to hold these other ones I have in my back pocket. Maybe when you have me on, I'll do a design failure, a historic design failure with you each time. So we got something to look forward to there. But
the more content we have in the pipeline, the more episodes we can schedule regularly. So
I have literally hundreds of these in my back pocket, and that one was just kind of the easiest one for me to go to, but we can definitely put that on. But yeah, Colorado, absolutely happy to move on that direction.
Awesome. Guys, we're gonna wrap this one up to make it a separate episode, thank you so much for listening, and I'm gonna put all the contact information for Doug in the podcast episode notes. And thank you so much for listening. Really, really appreciate your time. And Doug, thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on. Very happy to be a guest. And we'll talk to you all about Colorado here in a few.
All righty.